What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
I am John Fort, in for Kelly Evans, and here's what's ahead on The Exchange. Stocks falling today on a disappointing jobs number, though the NASDAQ holding on to a small gain. But Robinhood soars on the return of meme mania, perhaps. We'll talk to a five-star fund manager. And is refusing to get the COVID vaccine the new smoking? Former Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is going to join us to discuss how insurers should handle the unvaccinated. And doing the pandemic pivot, we will talk to the founders of two different businesses who are evolving along with, well, can you call it a new normal? But we begin with the market action. Christina Partsinevelis with the numbers. Christina.
Thank you, John. So markets are reversing yesterday's gains when the S&P 500 closed at yet again another record high. The Fed offering some mixed messages about tapering. You got the Delta variant on the table, along with a notable slowdown in June ADP private payrolls, adding to some of this downward trend. All sectors are lower across the board. Energy, the lowest, down over 2%, and that's following lower crude. And then you've got, I want to focus on consumer staples for a bit, because that's among the worst performers. Why? The sector was brought down by food earnings from Kraft, despite earnings topping expectations. You also got shares of CVS lower, despite a beat on earnings. The company, though, announced it would raise wages to $15 an hour starting July 2022. And so when you think about the money involved with that, it's going to add roughly about $485 million extra in labor costs. And let's talk about what's shaken on the NASDAQ. AMD and Robinhood. Those are the number one and number two most active stocks, both trading. AMD was well over 50 million, but now Robinhood, well over 140 million shares trading hands. AMD has hit a record share price 5 days in a row after the company said quarterly sales hit an all-time high in the second quarter. And it's been a wild ride for the trading app Robinhood. Trading was actually halted several times today, so you can see those drops right there. The stock even hit a gain of 81% over yesterday's close. There's no major catalyst, but Hood, right now, I just checked on QuiverQuant. It's the most mentioned stock on Wall Street Bets today. And ARK Invest, Kathy Wood, purchased about 89,000 shares yesterday. John, back to you.
Yeah, all good in the hood if you own it. Thanks, Christina. Joining me now to weigh in on the return of the meme trade, perhaps, and give us his best ideas in the tech sector right now is Michael Lippert, former, portfolio manager, still, of Barron Opportunity Fund. The five-star fund is up nearly 10% this year and about 130% since last year's pandemic low. Mike, so tell me what is going on, you think, in this market. Overall, it's a bit tough, but AMD was under 100 until a couple days ago, before earnings. Now, all of a sudden, it's got this attention, which I guess, is a short-term good thing, but there's a real company underneath that, too.
Yeah, I would say about AMD, it is obviously a real company underneath it, and there's obviously, big long-term trends, whether you think about what's going on with AI, artificial intelligence, what do you think about building out data centers, whether you think about what they're able to do in computing versus, their old competitor of Intel. So there's much more of a long-term trend in AMD than, perhaps in Robinhood, which you mentioned on the lead-in.
But I guess what I'm wondering is, you look at things like GameStop, right, which had clear issues, clear problems. There were a lot of people betting against it. You look at BlackBerry or any number of other stocks that sort of got caught up in this early on. Even Robinhood, right, which is a relatively recent IPO. Just a few days ago, there's controversy around it. But AMD is a whole different sort of stock. It's had this track record, as you mentioned, of really, beating up on Intel, stealing market share. What does it say that a stock like this is getting caught up in a retail frenzy, even as the overall market indices are treading water?
Listen, John, anything can happen in the short term. And so, our firm, Barron, we don't focus a lot on the short-term dynamics or short-term trading. You can get a lot of retail attention. We do focus on secular growth, companies that can grow faster for longer, the power of compounding. And when you talk about AMD, and certainly you look at what they've done over the last 20 years, it fits much more into that camp.
So what do you do with some of your top holdings, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon? These are names that had strong earnings in the last cycle just a few days ago. But by and large, with a rare exception here and there, Alphabet in particular, they didn't move that much, I guess, because they had already been bid up quite nicely. But it raises questions for me on, even with outstanding results, even, you know, these big tech names, how much further do they have to run?
I think it depends on the names you're talking about. So you highlighted a couple of the big names that everybody owns, that everybody knows. And I think those are the kind of companies that have grown faster for longer and still have, you know, big growth opportunities ahead of them. When we think about faster for longer, we think about the power of the secular growth trend. We think about companies that have a large total addressable market, and there's still a lot of room to penetrate. We think about companies that have multiple TAMs, that have multiple chapters. And so some of the businesses that have really helped us over the last quarter are companies of that ilk. And I would just highlight Zoom Info, Gartner, and software company Atlassian that, you know, really, again, multiple TAMs, multiple ways to win faster for longer.
Yeah, let's talk about Atlassian for a minute. I remember when they had their IPO at the NASDAQ, got to talk to the founders there. It's sort of this area of DevOps in a way, the tools for building the technology of the future. Not as sexy in a way for those people who are wanting to buy stocks for things that they actually use sort of out in the world, the Apples, the Microsofts. But Atlassian, one of those stocks that's a real key for the people who are building technology of the future. How do you expect those companies to do, you know, throw names like PagerDuty, HashiCorp might be coming public soon into the soup. How do you expect those names to do as even this market cycle maybe comes to an end?
Yeah, listen, I won't talk about all the names, but I will talk about Atlassian. I will talk about DevOps. I mean, we live in a world of technology first, right? The rubric over the last year has been technology, you know, transformation. Every company today is becoming a technology company. You have to build technology. You have to build apps. You have to be able to interact with your customers where they are at whatever time they need. And Atlassian and other companies, but Atlassian is right in the middle of that. And so it may not be sexy to people at home because it's not the Netflix they turn on or the Amazon they order a product from. But when you think about the information technology world today and how you know, applications are being developed to help businesses interact with their own customers, they are very, very well positioned. And the other interesting thing about them, when you talk about second and third acts, they're not only focused on DevOps. They started in DevOps, but they're, you know, expanding to workflow and helping teams collaborate across the entire organization, not just your DevOps teams.
I wonder what you think about what I think is a trend that I've seen over the past several weeks and maybe months, which is some of these high flyers during this pandemic period making acquisitions, making bets in essence that are not quite as risky as you might think. I'm thinking about Zoom acquiring Five9. I'm thinking about Square going after Afterpay. You know, it would be one thing if Zoom were doubling down on consumer, which was big for it over the past year, or Square was moving and making some big crypto acquisition, but they're not doing that. What does that signal, you think, about some of these companies' ambitions and what investors at home should be doing?
Yeah, well, I think it, you know, really speaks to what I talked about. And, you know, we've been technology investors and investors in growth companies for many, many years. It's a colloquialism, but faster for longer, that durability of growth is something I think that most investors miss. It is what allowed Google and Amazon and Apple over the years to be great companies. You know, having more than just one product or service, so having a second or third act, that's exactly what both of these companies are doing, right? So Zoom is the leader in video, but they understand that we're moving to a world of what's called unified communications, video and phone. And they also have to service the call centers. And so they bought, you know, the best asset out there in terms of Five9s and were able to use their stock. Fantastic acquisition. When you think about Square, where they are with, you know, both sellers and all of us, you know, using Cash App, but they looked at what was going on with Buy Now and Pay Later, and they saw an opportunity to acquire the leading asset there, to go to market faster, to expand themselves internationally, to expand themselves up market into larger sellers. And we also thought that was a very good acquisition.
All right. Well, we will, of course, be watching how that plays out. Michael Lippert with the Barron Opportunity Fund. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And meanwhile, a different look. After decades of avoiding politics at the Fed, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen now is hitting the road to help promote the president's economic agenda. Ilan Moy has details. Ilan.
Well, John, she's in Atlanta today. It's her first domestic trip as Treasury Secretary. And her main message is that the trillions of dollars in spending the president has proposed are essential for the U.S. to remain the world's superpower.
So my largest concern is not what are the risks if we make these big investments. It is what is the cost if we don't.
Now, Yellen called out four destructive forces that threaten the nation's long-term growth: declining labor force participation, wage polarization, racial inequality, and climate change.
Fiscal policy can help unwind them, or the lack thereof can intensify them. And we know this because that's exactly what's happened over the past 40 years.
Yellen is hoping this trip will help rally public support for both the bipartisan infrastructure bill and Democrats' own $3.5 trillion spending package. She also made that case privately to business leaders this morning, including Ed Bastian of Delta Airlines, John Hope Bryan of Operation Hope, Ryan Marshall of Pulte Group, and Alfredo Rivera, North American president at Coke. Now, John, Yellen did acknowledge that there's a good faith debate over how much government spending is too much, but she said that now is actually the most fiscally strategic time to make these investments. Back over to you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder, as you look at the various economic spokespeople that President Biden has at his disposal, what is the benefit or liability of having a former Fed chair who knows so many business leaders and is used to, I guess, the hot lights of you know, perception and watching every word she says?
Yeah, so she is someone who has a lot of credibility, I think, both with business leaders and with lawmakers on Capitol Hill. So when she talks, she doesn't really sound like sort of a partisan player. She sounds like someone who's explaining the president's priorities, though she is making a forceful case for them. However, the flip side, she's not a wheeler and dealer. She's not the person in the room haggling those last final details of the bills with lawmakers directly. President Biden, in fact, likes to do that himself quite often.
All right. Well, we'll see if they can get their agenda across the finish line. Elon, thanks. And coming up, this automaker is on pace for its worst day since March 2020 and threatening to break below its 200-day moving average. We will tell you what's behind the move lower. But first, should health insurers charge people who refuse to get the COVID vaccine higher premiums? We will speak with one of the architects behind the Affordable Care Act about that next.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
More than 70% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, about a month behind President Biden's goal. And with cases back on the rise, some are wondering whether the threat of higher insurance premiums could help sway unvaccinated people to finally get a shot. Bertha Coombs has a closer look at whether or not that's even legal. Bertha.
Yeah, that is the question, John. You know, under the Affordable Care Act, health plans can't discriminate against you based on your health status, but they can charge you more if you smoke because of the potential associated medical costs. In a Times op-ed, Kaiser Health News' Elizabeth Rosenthal and Stanford professor Glenn Kremen argue that people who remain unvaccinated should also pay a surcharge because if they're hospitalized with COVID, costs could easily top six figures and ultimately push all of our premiums higher. Now, Christine Groh, a spokesperson for America's health insurance plan, says insurers are still very much focused on incentives rather than punitive measures to get people to become immunized. But They'll make you pay more than last year if you get sick now. Cynthia Cox, vice president of Kaiser Family Foundation, says employers and insurers have mostly cut out those COVID cost waivers. So now you'll face big co-pays for hospitalization. And while the courts have upheld vaccine mandates for more than a century now, and in June, a Texas court actually rejected a suit by nurses over Houston Methodist Hospital's mandate, Georgetown law professor Lawrence Gostin told me the courts would likely reject a surcharge on the unvaccinated under the ACA. He argues that kind of blame and shame would really pose a slippery slope. Now, the latest KFF tracking poll finds that while numbers of those who are hesitant to get the jab are coming down, outright resistance remains steady. And John, you know, I doubt that a surcharge would really make those numbers budge.
Does this come down to the question of whether vaccine hesitancy and, you know, putting aside people who for medical reasons have concerns about whether the vaccine would work for them, whether it's a pre-existing condition or more like a choice, whether it's like a condition, right? Because, I mean, if it is like smoking, which is a choice, at least at first, what would the issue be?
But the issue is with smoking, there really is no way to smoke and not really incur health effects, right? There's no healthy way to smoke. If you're lucky, you will not end up with heart disease or end up with, you know, a lung issue, and they're not going to charge you more when and if you do get COPD. But with a vaccine, you may not get the disease. So it's not the same sort of deliberate cause and effect. The other thing is that right now, it certainly couldn't happen for next year. We are past that point. The rates are set for 2022. So it would be very, very difficult. And Cynthia Cox says it would be difficult to really actually track it down because there's no national registry for vaccines. And in some states, it's a little bit, still unclear whether someone gets one and there'll be registry on the state depending on where they get it. So logistically, it's also kind of difficult to do. But most people feel like it's really not going to convince that 14-15% that is outright rejecting the vaccine. You really have to have persuasion.
All right, Bertha, thank you. So are higher health care premiums enough to encourage more people to get vaccinated? Joining me now is a key architect of the ACA, former Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius. It's great to have you. I wonder about this because it seems to me that the insurance companies are going to have to calculate risk for the unvaccinated one way or another and what the potential costs are, whether they're doing it to pass along those costs, right, to the person with insurance or not. Aren't they going to have to figure that out?
Well, I think they will. The good news about insurance, most insurance now, is it doesn't take into account pre-existing conditions. And while there are a lot of encouragements around people getting preventive services, you waive co-pays, you waive co-insurance, there aren't really a lot of sticks at the end of the day. So I think here's one of the things insurers could do pretty quickly. Most of them had in place waivers for any kind of copay or deductible if somebody was hospitalized, if somebody was treated for COVID. A lot of those policies have ceased now that we have a vaccine. You could actually put them back in place for people who have breakthrough infections, the very few people who end up in the hospital who have already been vaccinated, and make sure that people understand that you will not get any kind of break on a copay or a deductible. Even if you're insured, you're going to pay the maximum amount if you are unvaccinated and end up in the hospital. I think it's much more complicated to talk about insurers trying to change premium prices because you'd have to collect a lot of information. And in most cases, in employee plans and others, you cannot, you know, individually medically underwrite people, which is what we'd be talking about, looking right at that specific thing. So, but employers have a lot of vaccine mandates that they can put in place, which could be very effective beyond their insurance.
So bottom line, though, do you expect this pandemic to change either the questions that insurers ask and maybe even employers ask, or the incentives that they give when it comes to things like vaccines, because it just really feels like this issue is going to extend beyond this particular pandemic, whether it ends soon, which of course we all hope, or not.
Well, as far as I know, there is no current insurance penalty for the anti-vaccine community, right? The people who just refuse to get vaccinations, refuse to vaccinate their kids, whatever. That could change with this. That could actually be something that is implemented on a go-forward basis. I think it would be, would require congressional intervention to change the rules for Medicaid and Medicare. As I say, you don't medically underwrite people. You don't ask individual questions. It's more rating. But insurance companies definitely could make sure that if the very few people who have a breakthrough infection continue to get waivers on copays and deductibles for their hospital stay, continue to be protected from out-of-pocket costs, and again, make it very clear that if you're unvaccinated, none of that is in place for you. So it's more of an incentive that could be done very quickly, and I think that might make a difference. It's hard to know what is going to make a difference with folks. I think also the FDA moving as expeditiously as possible and getting to full approval would be very helpful.
What about this movement toward encouraging, insurance holders toward healthier living, encouraging exercise, working out, wearing technology that tracks that sort of thing? Would encouraging vaccines versus penalizing the unvaccinated work in that same frame?
Well, I think it probably could. Again, there are lots of incentives in place around what is so-called preventive health. If you, are a pre-diabetic and you enter a weight loss program and an exercise program, you all often have an incentive and offered by your company or your insurer. If you, get your screenings in a timely basis, you get incentives. So this is definitely preventive healthcare, to get vaccinated, to make sure you don't have these very expensive hospital stays and potentially death, which is, the ultimate penalty. So I think incentives fit into the category that has been tried for a long time. And actually has had some real impact on people's behavior, and smoking cessation programs work. We know that. So hopefully vaccines and incentives could work.
Well, we hope that people make the best and healthiest decisions for themselves and their families is the bottom line. Kathleen Sebelius, former HHS secretary. Thank you. Now, coming up, we are highlighting business owners who made a pandemic pivot and are now seeing it pay off. We will look at the future of education also and entertainment. Plus, Viva Las Vegas, one landowner is making a big bet on Sin City's turnaround. We will bring you the details behind this multi-billion dollar deal.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Rahel Solomon, and here is your CNBC News update at this hour. The current Surgeon General meeting with six of his predecessors to answer questions about the latest surge in COVID cases due to the Delta variant. Surgeon General Murthy saying that there is a realistic possibility that we will need vaccine booster shots. And on the news, reevaluating bans on mask mandates, a look at growing cases in Arkansas, and the governor's push to re-examine a ban that he just signed months ago. In Geneva, the head of the World Health Organization is calling for a moratorium on COVID vaccine boosters. He wants wealthy nations to focus on spreading doses to countries where few people have received a single shot. The UN agency says that no one will be safe from COVID until everyone is safe and the risk of developing new variants is minimized. And in Beirut, protesters clashing with security forces on the first anniversary of the blast that destroyed the port and large sections of the city. Water cannons and tear gas were fired at protesters throwing rocks at officers near the country's parliament. You're now up to date. John, I'll send it back to you.
Rahel, thank you. And coming up, how Bitcoin investors who pay their taxes could actually benefit from the new infrastructure bill And let's get a little show and tell before we head to break. That's where we show the stock and tell the story. Shares of Lyft are on pace for their worst day since April, despite strong earnings. The company says it expects prices to decline in Q3, but still plans on maintaining elevated new driver bonuses and incentives. Thus, Lyft President John Zimmer told Squawk Box he's not worried about a driver shortage.
The supply and demand imbalance happens, but it is getting better. Quarter over quarter, we welcome 50% more new drivers than we did last quarter. And again, we were able to hit adjusted EBITDA profitability with driver earnings at an all-time high and demand growing as well.
Welcome back. Bitcoin climbing higher after touching its lowest level since July 27th, still below 40K at the moment, though. SEC Chairman Gary Gensler appeared on Squawk Box today and reiterated his cautious position on crypto.
And if people want to take risk, that's all right. But what we want to do is provide them some of the basic protections against fraud and manipulation. The trading platforms they're on are not currently under a regulatory regime that protects them like they're trading on the New York Stock Exchange. It just isn't. And I think those are gaps, and I think that's not good for investors, and I don't think it's good for the technology.
And while the SEC is working on regulations for crypto trading, the bipartisan infrastructure bill contains a new tax requirement for crypto exchanges that could actually help some investors. Robert Frank, you got some details?
John, we do, actually. The new infrastructure bill raises an estimated $28 billion from cracking down on crypto tax evasion. But for investors who do pay their taxes, there is a potential upside. Now, to comply with the new rules, crypto exchanges like Coinbase or Binance will have to start producing tax forms known as 1099Bs. So rather than having to calculate their own taxes, crypto holders will get an easy-to-read form that's also sent to the IRS. Now, in some cases, the rules could even help lower taxes. Crypto holders who use tax loss harvesting, that's where you take losses on money-losing crypto positions to offset gains, they will have much clearer records that right now, if you move crypto from one exchange to another, the exchanges don't provide any information on your cost basis. So that makes it a lot harder to track losses. The new rules will provide a detailed history of each crypto purchase or sale, even if you transfer the tokens. Bottom line here, the new rules will tell the government who is avoiding crypto taxes, but it could also help those who play by the rules. Imagine that, John, a tax code that rewards those who play by the rules.
I believe it when I see it, Robert Frank. Does it reward them as much as those who kind of play by the letter of the rules, but manage to find some loopholes? And it also seems like there's some opportunity here, both for specialists to deal with the ultra rich around crypto issues and maybe even for software. I don't know if you're hearing anything about that.
No question. I mean, there's a whole new cottage industry that's cropped up just in the last year. And I talked to a lot of them for this particular reporting of tax advisors to crypto holders because it's complicated. As Gensler just said, the rules are a little amorphous right now. It's kind of the Wild West. So there is a brand new thriving business around taxes and crypto and investing.
Yeah, that's who wins no matter what. The people who are prepared to specialize
right.
in helping you pay as little as possible in the new thing. Robert, thanks. And while the Biden administration and Congress are working out how to tax digital assets in the infrastructure bill, the federal government itself has a secret stash of Bitcoin. I bet you were guessing that that might be the case. CNBC.com reporter Mackenzie Sigalos has been following that story. Mackenzie, how big? Do we know how big this stash is?
Yeah, so the government has a stockpile and they have accrued it from all of these different agencies. So the FBI does these raids and the IRS does these raids. And I spoke to someone at the IRS who kind of heads up this mission, and they say that so far in fiscal year 2021, they've taken in $1.2 billion in Bitcoin. So it's not too small a collection of crypto.
So what are they going to do with that? It reminds me of, cash seized or maybe contraband seized in government raids, and they have to figure out ways, I guess, to turn that into into something that helps fund the government. But with crypto, is there a government wallet? What do they do?
Yeah, so essentially what happens is you have all these agencies that are able to seize the, you know, the crypto assets, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it is Litecoin or Ethereum, and it goes into this digital wallet. And then once the case is closed, once everything is settled, it gets passed on to the U.S. Marshals Service. And that is the group that's tasked with actually auctioning off this cryptocurrency. And it's kind of funny because this is what they do with other raids where you've got, you know, planes and cars that are taken in some of these seizure operations. But that's how they're also selling their Bitcoin. And so that's like the next stage of the process. And then once they liquidate all of the cryptocurrency, it goes into two funds that are then reallocated to, you know, either Congress, like, you know, stakes a claim over some of those funds, or it goes back to the agencies that actually collected the cryptocurrency in the first place.
I wonder, I mean, there are numerous movie plots with this kind of what happens to this big stash of cash that the government, you know, either the U.S. government or some other government ends up confiscating, and, you know, does it end up on the back of a truck? Crypto itself being in some ways really easy to track, but then in some ways really hard. I wonder if there are concerns about whether all of that money really ends up going where it's supposed to go.
Sure. And there have been concerns about that, and people have expressed that. I've reached out to see if there's any sort of comprehensive central database that keeps track both of, you know, the cryptocurrency that's brought in during these, you know, during these raids, but then subsequently auctioned. And that's been one of the critiques over the last few years, the fact that, you know, there isn't one, you know, standard database that you can go to. And there are so many different agencies that are actually collecting this cryptocurrency. So and then it's also being collected at the state level. So there are a lot of variables there to consider.
Yeah, there's a good movie plot in there too, I'm sure. Mackenzie Sigalos, thank you. And now coming up, the pandemic has forced businesses large and small to evolve, to make changes. We will talk to the CEO of a digital education platform for children and catch up with the co-founders of a drive-in theater in Newark, New Jersey, about how they've pivoted over the past year or leaned into their missions and what's next for their businesses. The Exchange, we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. Markets mixed right now with the Dow, the biggest laggard of the major indices. Here are some of the movers this hour. Airlines moving lower as the summer of disruptions continues for the carriers. Spirit is one of the biggest laggards after canceling half of its flights today to reboot operations due to a mix of bad weather, staffing shortages, and tech issues. Shares of the pet care platform Rover are moving higher today after JMP initiated the stock with an outperform rating and a $15 price target. The analyst calls it the leading online marketplace for pet care in North America, with more than a million unique pet parents and a prime beneficiary of the pet adoption trend due to the pandemic. Shares are up 15% since Rover closed its SPAC deal on Monday. And our mystery chart of the day was GM, down about 8% and on pace for its worst day since March 2020 after missing earnings expectations despite a record operating profit. It also raised its guidance for the year, but the automaker took a big hit from warranty recall costs, including $800 million related to the Chevy Bolt EV. And we're calling it the pandemic pivot. Businesses big and small have had to readjust over the past year and a half. We'll talk to two small business owners about the moves they've made and what's working next. Welcome back. COVID cases are surging across the country, but some businesses that readjusted or were started during the pandemic are prepared. While school districts struggled to transition to a remote learning system, the education tech company Encantos has been working since 2015 to create a robust and diverse virtual learning experience with digital story teaching to help kids learn through play, even at home. And outdoor entertainment venues also are effective at keeping people safer while also connecting communities. The drive-in theater, Newark Moonlight Cinema, is back in action after its successful run last year. Let's start with education. With us now is Stephen Wolf Pereira, co-founder and CEO of Encantos. Stephen, so you started this company with your wife and friends back before EdTech was as cool as it is now. What kinds of pressures and opportunities have you seen during this time, especially as we get ready for back to school?
Absolutely, John. Well, thanks for having us. And holy cow, it took a global pandemic to make EdTech cool. I think when 9 out of 10 kids around the planet were stuck at home, people realized what the hell are our kids learning? And more specifically, they're not learning 21st century skills. They're learning literacy and life skills that they need to thrive in this century. And so we saw throughout the pandemic this incredible demand for things that are going to be not just focused on 21st century skills. There also was this incredible demand for diversity, equality, and inclusion and representation, especially with over 50% of kids being diverse.
So what's going to happen now as we, I guess, move toward reopening, but it's probably not going to be smooth in the fall. It's going to be different by a different geographic area. And I think a lot of parents have realized that there's an extra burden of doing more from home, whether it's getting the equipment or it's being more hands-on with the learning material. How is technology and Encanto going to play into that?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, everyone talks about, you know, the K economy. What you're seeing is K education, where parents have actually figured out how to take education into their own hands. And so parents that had means, they actually hired private teachers, private tutors for their kids, and they accelerated. But think about all the parents and families that couldn't do that. So you actually have a widening education gap. And now parents are really looking for new ways to actually continue the learning from the classroom into the living room. And so you're going to see a demand for homeschooling, enrichment, supplemental, you know, tools and resources. And that's where Encantos comes in. We're actually a story teaching platform. Think of us as a global creator platform that's connecting creators that we call story teachers with kids and families so they can actually learn these 21st century skills. So effectively, we're democratizing and diversifying learning.
Is there more interest from investors coming to platforms like Encantos now? And what is it that they expect or hope to see in terms of growth, both revenue-wise and user-wise?
Absolutely. Well, next week actually marks the beginning of the ASU GSV annual EdTech conference. Think of it as like the Davos for EdTech. Everyone's going to be there. And, you know, the reality is EdTech has never been more in demand. So investors are now realizing that this is not going to be a one-time fad, that there is incredible need for things that are going to help kids learn at home. So the homeschooling market, you know, whereas that might have been a dirty word, you know, a few years ago, everyone is looking for ways to continue learning at home. So there is incredible demand. And then look at what has been happening in the public markets. Think about Coursera going public. Think about Roblox going public. And then Duolingo just went public, 2 weeks ago? So there's incredible demand for ed tech. There's incredible demand for the creator economy. And Encantos is actually merging both of those things.
Yeah, Coursera reporting earnings today. And that demand from consumers was reflected. Stephen, thank you.
Thanks so much, John.
And now last year on The Exchange, we met the team behind Newark Moonlight Cinema. The drive-in was founded during the pandemic to screen films highlighting Black filmmakers, actors and actresses to socially distanced crowds. Newark Moonlight has expanded in 2021, adding a second screen, a restaurant, and more outdoor entertainment offerings. And with us now, Ayanna Morris and Sari Morris, co-owners of Newark Moonlight Cinema. Great to have you guys. So, I mean, a lot of people thought we were about to go back to movies indoors, and now we're thinking again, how is this uncertainty affecting your plans?
Well, because we're able to allow our patrons to naturally social distance, you know, we are a choice of moviegoers. You know, you could come, you can be with the people that you've already been quarantining with, you feel comfortable with the people you live with, you know, you come down, you're in your car, and you have a great experience while you watch a movie.
Yeah, there's kind of a romance to the drive-in idea. And I looked at the movies that you guys are showing. It's movies we like, you know. You know, The Last Dragon in there. We showed our kids that movie not too long ago. You know, The Glow and whatnot. What kind of a community impact is this having? And perhaps even when it comes to local businesses surrounding that have been hit so hard by this pandemic.
I think that the community really, really receives it very well. We get a lot of families, a lot of couples. It's a great date night spot. You know, even during the construction and while we were building it out, we would have literally maybe 10 to 15 people come through and just thank us, whether we're in ShopRite, whether we're wherever we're at. So the community received it very, very well, and they are actually excited that we were able to make it permanent, and it's our goal to make it a mainstay in the city of Newark.
So what is your plan or your hope strategically to make this something that isn't just convenient during a time of theater uncertainty, but something that continues when, you know, Lord willing, we're out of this pandemic state? Are you in the process of figuring out how to either add enhancements over time or more first run movies? What?
Yeah, so we understand that we are not operating in a healthy economy, and that calls for more marketing, that calls for more pivoting and adding to our outdoor entertainment venue experience. So we, it's our goals to show other content, get more first-run films, do brunches. We have a restaurant with great food, so we want to highlight that as much as possible as well.
And just kind of mechanically, how does it work at this stage? Like, I know that there's been the kind of the speakers by the side of the window model for this, or they're, you know, up by the stands. What do you hope and expect the drive-in experience becomes like over time for people who maybe haven't been to a drive-in either ever or in a few decades?
I would like to see the experience modernized. I know that movie theaters are a thing, drive-ins are a thing. I think a nice combo of an indoor-outdoor movie theater experience is a smart way to go in the 21st century.
All right. Well, best of luck to you and to the city of Newark. I live in the county, so I hope maybe I can swing by and see some of those.
Yes, we have to come
through.
Yeah.
Got to come through, have a good time. It's a phenomenal, it's a really, really good experience.
You know, and check out the food, too. The food has always got to be part of the drive-in experience. Ayanna and Sari Morris, thank you. And you don't want to miss CNBC's Small Business Playbook on August 11th, featuring a star-studded lineup designed to give you the tools and knowledge to make the most of the economic recovery. You can register to attend at cnbcevents.com/smallbusiness. And up next, a big deal in gaming earlier today. One landlord is making a $17 billion bet on the Las Vegas Strip. The details of the deal are next. The Exchange. I'll be right back. Welcome back. A huge real estate acquisition in the gaming sector today. Contessa Brewer joins me now with the deal details. Contessa.
Hi there, John. Yeah, VICI Properties is acquiring MGM Growth Properties in a deal valued at $17.2 billion. That will give VICI a market cap upon closure of roughly $45 billion. I mean, that is far larger than any of its casino tenants and the preeminent experiential REIT. VICI is looking to diversify its portfolio property, or its property portfolio, rather. When it was created, Caesars was its only tenant, and it will remain its largest. But now it's adding 15 MGM properties. That helps VICI expand geographically. And this deal likely will make VICI the biggest landowner on the Las Vegas Strip. In an exclusive interview with me, VICI's CEO Edward Pitoniak told me why he's so focused on casinos.
What's really been gratifying is the way in which gaming operators have validated themselves as what we believe are the most dynamic, resourceful leisure entertainment hospitality operators on earth. No one else has come through COVID like them. No one else was capable of paying 100% of their rent in cash on time.
In fact, Caesars just announced second quarter results that broke all-time records, profit margins above 50% in Las Vegas. That's without any meaningful convention business. And, you know, that's typically crucial to the midweek revenues. And it's with 2 months of 50% occupancy restrictions, mask mandates, and social distancing. Caesars CEO Tom Reeg told me he does not anticipate a significant hurdle from either rising infections from the COVID Delta variant, nor from mask mandates being reintroduced as they have been in Las Vegas and Louisiana. One thing the casinos haven't yet done, at least as a group, is reintroduced shareholder dividends. VICI, on the other hand, just raised its dividend by 9% to $1.44 annually. So that should make this somewhat attractive to investors, guys.
Contessa, educate me on the kind of gaming real estate business here, because I have this image of the Las Vegas Strip as a place where they blow up a hotel, you know, every few years and build something brand new there. If you're a big owner of a lot of that, does that then fall on you to have to destroy and rebuild your own property every few years?
I mean, let's see if that continues to be the way that it goes. Because, for instance, we saw Blackstone buying the property under Bellagio. You've got a real effort on the part of MGM to go asset light. That means they want to focus on doing what they say they do best, which is operating casinos and resorts and entertainment experiences. VICI, on the other hand, is coming in like they just did. They made a deal with Las Vegas Sands to buy the property under the Venetian, the Palazzo, the Expo. For them, it works well to own the land, to charge their tenants rent, and know that those tenants are going to be good for the money. This is sort of the way that it's been going, and it's not just in Las Vegas. It's happening with the regional properties, too. So, for instance, VICI will get MGM National Harbor in the D.C. area. It will get MGM Springfield, which is part of a deal that MGP just made for. That's MGM Growth property that it just made with MGM to buy the property under the Springfield Casino. That's the way it's going in gaming.
Quickly, if you can, how are they handling? I mean, I know Vegas is used to handling risk and coming out on top, but how are they handling COVID risk? I'm sure there are a lot of people who want to be out and about without masks and whatnot, but if the workforce gets sick, is there danger there that they'll have to scale back?
They basically, what they've done is they've rolled out the signs again that say you have to mask up. That's the mandate. And they don't think it's going to interfere with the business because, again, if you look at Caesars results, they had 2 out of 3 months in this quarter where people had to wear masks inside. The pent-up demand is just there. And Reek says he thinks it's persistent.
All right. Contessa, thank you.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day. Same time, same place.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.